Hello, my name is Gary Brothers, and in this podcast, I'm going to explain to you HM Revenue and Customs' new toolkit designed to reduce errors. HM Revenue and Customs have decided to help you to do your job. Great news, I hear you all cry. What HMRC are actually going to do, and I think sensibly, is to tell us all in the profession what the most common mistakes are that they see, and to give us all some help in avoiding those mistakes. Of course, HMRC states from a basis of mistakes, and there are few who can say they've never made a mistake. But this help also helps HMRC. They are shrinking their staff numbers dramatically, and the days of teams of tax inspectors only undertaking tax investigations are changing and perhaps long gone. Being no mistake, those days cannot ever completely disappear, otherwise who would police the tax system watching for those who deliberately set out to avoid or evade their taxes? But what HMRC are doing is moving the tax regulatory world to one where risk management or risk assurance is as valuable as remedial correction by HMRC. HMRC are saying, if you can show that you've taken reasonable care to make an accurate return, you will get a much lighter regulatory approach as a consequence. This is where HMRC's launch of its toolkits comes into play. So first, let's find the toolkits and then I'll talk about them. Begin at HMRC's website, then click the Tax Agents and Advisors button in the top right-hand corner. On the Tax Agents page, scroll down the See Also list on the right-hand side and click Toolkits. This will then take you to the Toolkits page. So, to repeat for you, HMRC website, click Tax Agents and Advisors, scroll down the See Also section on the right until you see Toolkits and click on that. What you'll then see is the HMRC introductory page for toolkits. What is interesting is that HMRC say on this web page that the toolkits, basically HMRC guidance to reduce errors they see frequently, should help advisors to 1. Ensure that returns are completed correctly, minimizing errors. I'm okay with that so far. 2. Focus on areas of possible error that HMRC consider key. Still okay, I think, although maybe weighted a bit towards HMRC's own beliefs. And 3. To demonstrate reasonable care. Now, this demonstrating reasonable care point is important because the new penalty regime that exists for tax errors meant that even if an error has been made, where reasonable care has been taken, HMRC will not pursue a financial penalty for that error. So, having that as background, that means that following the relevant toolkit should avoid errors being made, but even if they are, there should be no penalty sought, as the client should still meet the reasonable care test. I am also aware that HMRC are considering a tick box on future returns to show who has and has not used the toolkit's guidance when compiling return entries. But, I think understandably, the various professional bodies think that this is a step too far. As they say, many people get their return entries correct without using this toolkit guidance, and not following HMRC's toolkit, and with it then not ticking a box, should not automatically mean that HMRC can simply identify these people to ask questions to ensure that the return is filed properly. Watch this space though, and we'll see where that consultation takes us. So, what toolkits are there? Well, 6 have been released initially and cover, 1. Capital gains tax for land and buildings. 2. Marginal small companies relief. 3. Private and personal expenditure. 4. Capital allowances for plant and machinery. 5. Trusts and estates. And 6. Capital gains for trusts and estates. Because trusts and estates presents a more specialist area, this podcast won't look at those two toolkits, although of course they are available on the website if needed. Now remember, these are the areas within which HMRC say they find most mistakes and is why they want to give the toolkit guidance for each. So HMRC are saying that they see most mistakes in the areas of capital gains for land and buildings, marginal small companies relief, private and personal expenditure, capital allowances for plant and machinery, and trusts and estates, including capital gains within trusts and estates. My initial reaction is that I think I can agree with HMRC that those areas are complicated, although I don't immediately see personal and private expenditure automatically feeding through to return entries. But we'll see when we review that toolkit shortly. What I would like to do is to look at each of the toolkits in turn. This won't be an in-depth look at each, as time doesn't allow that, but let's look at each nonetheless, picking out the main points. So, and in no order of importance, let's begin with looking at the capital gains toolkit to see what guidance it gives us. The introduction to the toolkit is on page 3 and is neutral and professional, as you would expect. It acknowledges that most people try and do get their taxes right. The introduction also says that using the toolkit is entirely voluntary. Do remember, though, that this guidance is also HMRC's own published guidance on how it believes the capital gains legislation operates, and the introduction accepts that. Whether the toolkit is appropriate to non-standard or more complex capital gains, land and building transactions, I'll leave to you to decide. Also, don't lose sight of the purpose of the toolkit. It is HMRC saying these are the most common errors we see in a way that allows people making the same mistakes to avoid. So again, the application of the toolkit is general. The underlying legislation is what governs the capital gains tax regime, and some care should be taken to avoid seeing the toolkit as the definitive answer on all matters relating to capital gains tax. That is not the purpose. The other interesting point to note, and again in this area on seeing HMRC guidance as just that, guidance rather than law, most of the backup to the toolkit makes reference to HMRC's capital gains manual instructions rather than the law. Again, don't forget, this is purely HMRC's own interpretation of what it thinks the law says, so please be aware of that. The capital gains toolkit then gives HMRC's view of what the main capital gains tax risks are. We have to assume that this is from the most common errors HMRC see. So let's look at that. HMRC say that the five most common areas of risk are 1. Record keeping, 2. Disposals, 3. Valuations, 4. Expenditure, and 5. Reliefs. So, I would suggest that this is a pretty wide-reaching area. Because of that, I'd like to look at what HMRC say on each in a little more detail. So, to start with record keeping. HMRC win the state the obvious competition by saying good record keeping is essential and poor records might mean that not all information is either accurate or to hand. Interestingly, when we come to consider the more detailed checklists, risks and mitigations shortly, record keeping as a risk is then absent. I suspect we are always trying to educate our clients about the value of good records, whatever they're needed for, and the toolkit has no further secrets to reveal. What we can say is that HMRC tell us that good records are better and more accurate than poor ones. Well, moving on, the risk that HMRC call disposals does at least get a little more attention, thought and detail. HMRC tell us that for capital gains purposes, a disposal can be a sale, exchange, gift or all or part of an asset, and that a disposal can also include the loss or destruction of an asset. HMRC say the dates of these occasions are important, but that sometimes this can be more complicated, especially when there are different types of contract involved. So, for disposals for capital gains purposes, what does the checklist cover? For each of these questions, the possible answers are yes, no, or not applicable. So, to the questions. 1. Has the correct date of disposal been established? 2. Has market value been used instead of disposal proceeds where appropriate? 3. Did anyone else have an interest in the asset disposed of? 4. Has the asset been valued by a properly instructed, qualified, independent valuer? And 5. Where any of the consideration is deferred, has the treatment been correctly identified? Now don't forget, these are just the questions relating to the disposal, so some fairly wide-ranging questions indicating the range of complexity that can exist in capital gains disposals. So, what are the risks, or those apparent common errors, HMRC are trying to help us with? Well, it's pretty simple stuff, it has to be said. The explanation of risks, page 9 of the toolkit, relating to the date of the disposal, are designed to prompt thought to ensure that any gain is shown in the correct tax year, and a little narrative to warn people about the complexities of conditional and unconditional contracts in relation to capital gains tax disposals. Not the most comprehensive range of support, it has to be said. The market value prompt directs advisors to consider whether a market value should be substituted for actual proceeds and then tries to clarify when this may be relevant. For such a technically complex subject matter, I do question whether this is the right way to deal with advice on such a complicated matter, but at least there is a willingness to try to help, which is no bad thing. I have to say the most simplistic risk considered is the one concerning whether all those with an interest in an asset have disclosed any gain. As I say, a little simplistic, as there is then no guidance on what or how other interests may arise or exist. Again, the guidance relating to instructing a qualified valuer is perhaps not the clearest. Remember, in certain circumstances, the legislation requires a valuation to be substituted for an actual value, maybe if an asset is sold to a family member, maybe if a historical valuation is needed for inflation purposes. However, the legislation does not require the valuation to be by a qualified valuer. Of course, we all understand the relative merits of such an approach, but I would suggest the guidance is a little misleading in suggesting that is the only approach. The guidance on expenditure is largely what you would expect and part of the best practice I am sure we advise clients of in any event. Basically, the risks HMRC see on expenditure for capital gains suggest they are concerned at the technical allowability of some expenditure that they see, whether enhancement expenditure is always allowable, whether an adjusted expense is due for part disposals, and whether original costs claimed have been adjusted previously for such items as rollover claims. Again, some fairly basic errors, and I have to say, fairly standard fare for a competent tax agent or practicing member. Please read the guidance and be aware of it, but I do think that some areas will be far from new for many advisors. Moving on to HMRC's guidance on reliefs, we do see some interesting aspects. Having listened with interest to tales of MPs house flipping, it's interesting that a large section of the guidance is devoted to private residence relief. We start off with clarity on the only or main residence test, but then soon move on to slightly more obtuse areas, such as HMRC posing the question, has the entity of the dwelling house been correctly identified, or have the gardens and grounds of the dwelling house been correctly identified? Of course, consideration of those two questions, along with HMRC saying such risks show the most common errors they see, suggest that HMRC have been successful in challenging private residence gains claims simply by shrinking or reducing the main house residence that the exempt amount covers. A revealing area and clearly a pitfall to avoid. In fact, whilst I have only raised a couple of the most obvious questions HMRC pose here, the actual toolkit includes 9 discrete and separate risks that HMRC believe exist in private residence claims alone, the most risks by some distance, and perhaps not surprising, given that private residence relief claims, when successful, deliver a wholly tax-free gain, of course. The other capital gains relief that HMRC draw toolkit attention to, being the most error-prone, are gift relief, rollover relief, incorporation relief, and entrepreneurs relief. I won't go into great detail now on what the toolkit says about these issues, it's there for all to read, but it's a fairly basic mix of whether the condition for the relief is met, whether the asset qualifies for the relief, and then the computational help needed to get the relief correct. On balance then, for the capital gains toolkit, an interesting mix of the obvious and obscure to help advisors get clients' capital gains just for land and buildings correct. As Monty Python said, now for something completely different. A risk area that I know myself can be more complicated and contentious, and where I have helped both clients and their advisors alike, is that of marginal small companies relief in corporation tax cases. As I say, I think HMRC producing a guidance toolkit for this topic is a very good effort in the right direction. Again, the toolkit document starts with the useful introduction of how HMRC are looking to eliminate errors by giving advice on the most common areas of mistake, and the reminder that following the toolkit and showing you followed the toolkit will be acknowledged as taking reasonable care should there be any later errors. Like the toolkit for capital gains on land and buildings, HMRC first acknowledges risk is that of poor record keeping, and I suspect that moving into the newer risk-based checking regime, then the standard of a client's records and the extent to which they may have contributed to errors in returns will become a major consideration of HMRC in each case. The other risks that HMRC identify for marginal small companies relief are distilled down to just two further topics over and above poor record keeping, and they are 1. Incomplete information, and 2. Applying the correct rules. Again, not the most difficult of subjects for us advisors to lose sight of. However, take HMRC at their word. This is what they say they see wrong most often. So, let's look at each in a little more detail. In all, for small companies relief, HMRC give a total of only 11 risks. Remember that in the capital gains for land and buildings, there are 9 identified risks for private residence relief alone. So, HMRC have identified only 11 risks in total for marginal small companies relief. It makes sense for me to read each of them as they appear in the toolkit. Number 1. Have you, the advisor, checked the notes to the accounts to consider whether there are any associated companies? 2. Have you, the advisor, checked whether there are any non-UK resident companies associated with the company? 3. Have you checked whether there are any other companies associated with the company? 4. Have you considered whether any of the shareholders or participators control another company by themselves or with others? 5. Have all appropriate attribution of rights and powers been considered? 6. Have you considered whether control of a company is other than by shares? 7. Have all minimum controlling contributions been considered in establishing the level of control of a company? 8. If you consider extra statutory concession C9 applies, have you reviewed the specific test within the concession? 9. If the company is a close company, have you considered whether the company is a close investment holding company? 10. Have you reviewed any dormant companies to check whether they are dormant for small companies relief or marginal small companies relief purposes? 11. Has the correct rate of tax and marginal small companies relief been applied? And there you have it. For the marginal small companies relief, a list of a dozen, I think, self-explanatory questions, which apparently highlight the most common mistakes that HMRC see. With the possible exception of question 9, the close investment holding company risk, then I think the rest of the questions which indicate HMRC's risks are pretty straightforward. The toolkit's further explanations of these risks is also pretty obvious. I don't think we need to spend a great deal of time on them again, other than just to run through those questions once again and to reflect on them for a moment. So, question 1. Have you, the advisor, checked the notes to the accounts to consider whether there are any associated companies? Question 2. Have you, the advisor, checked whether there are any non-UK resident companies associated with the company? Question 3. Have you checked whether there are any other companies associated with the company? Question 4. Have you considered whether any of the shareholders or participators control another company by themselves or with others. Question 5. Have all appropriate attribution of rights and powers been considered? 6. Have you considered whether control of a company is other than by shares? 7. Have all minimum controlling contributions been considered in establishing the level of control of a company? 8. If you consider extra statutory concession C9 applies, have you reviewed the specific test within the concession? Question 9. If the company is a close company, have you considered whether the company is a close investment holding company? Question 10. Have you reviewed any dormant companies to check whether they are dormant for small companies relief or marginal small companies relief purposes? And finally, question 11. Have the correct rates of tax and marginal small companies relief been applied? So, having now pondered the toolkits for both capital gains tax on land and buildings, and also that for marginal small company relief, we come to a somewhat more intriguing toolkit, that for private and personal expenditure. I say more intriguing simply because the first two clearly had a direct link to the taxes they were concerned with. The correct year and size of a chargeable gain for the first, and the correct level of corporation tax for the second. This toolkit, however, is different, as we'll see the reason that it requires the advisor to adopt a much more investigative approach than might normally be the case. In fact, reading the 25 risk-based questions on the checklist, I was almost transported back to my days as an investigating inspector at the Inland Revenue. I could almost hear myself once again asking business owners these questions, while their advisors looked on. Now, of course, and if you choose to use the toolkit, you too can be an inspector for the day. I can sense your excited anticipation already. So, on first read of this toolkit, what jumps out? Well, like the others, we get the record keeping and reasonable care health warnings early on. But then, we're told HMRC are concerned with the number of cases they see where personal bills are put through as business expenses, where travel and subsistence is wrongly dealt with, and where entertaining, gifts, subscription and sponsorship are not properly identified to be able to be added back. The toolkit then says that HMRC also see cases where drawings, and therefore capital accounts, do not accurately reflect the real position. As I said earlier, ladies and gentlemen, this toolkit really is where HMRC anticipate you undertaking some investigation work for them. In all, HMRC identify 25 risk areas that advisors should be encouraged to consider if they are using this toolkit. I won't look at all 25, as some are simple and fairly standard. For example, have profits been adjusted appropriately for any entertaining expenses paid? With the obvious answer being yes, and these expenses have been added back to profits as inadmissible. What I would like to do, though, is to look at some of the more contentious or intrusive risk-based questions, so that you can follow them when you look at the actual toolkit document. I'll retain the same numbers for this podcast. So, what do I consider the more contentious questions and why? I'll read the questions first and then read them again with my thoughts. Question 2. Have any personal expenses paid by credit card been allocated to drawings? Question 6. Have any personal or household bills paid by the business been analysed and allocated appropriately? Question 11. Are all expenses claimed for business trips wholly and exclusively for business purposes? Question 12. If a family member accompanied the proprietor or partner on a business trip, have any associated non-business costs been disallowed? Question 13. Are all expenses claimed for meals and subsistence wholly and exclusively for business purposes? Question 17. Have any sponsorship payments made, particularly to connected parties, been reviewed? Question 20. If there have been wages or salaries paid to relatives or connected parties, are the amounts paid commensurate with their duties? Question 23. Has an appropriate adjustment been made for services provided to the proprietor or partner by the business? So, looking at what I believe are the more contentious questions for an advisor to pursue with a client, let's look at those questions again, taking also HMRC's further comments within the toolkit. So, question 2 asks, have any personal expenses paid by credit card been allocated to drawings? HMRC say that as personal credit cards are sometimes used for both personal and business expenses, advisors should be reviewing closely all such spending to pull out the private element and to post that amount to the drawings account. Of course, that treatment is correct, and I, nor anyone else, would suggest otherwise. But what about those cases where it is not clear if or where both business and personal expenditure goes together? HMRC's clear implication is that people have been doing this aspect wrong, either innocently or less so. But are we now to adopt a more investigative approach ourselves, rather than simply relying on our clients recording and identifying their expenses correctly? HMRC seem to think that we should be more investigative as practitioners. So, let's look at question 6. Question 6 says, have any personal or household bills paid by the business been analysed and allocated appropriately? Again, this has a similar ring to question 2 earlier. Basically, has the proprietor, innocently or otherwise, recorded expenditure in such a way that inadmissible personal expenditure is being claimed for a deduction? Interestingly, in HMRC's narrative on the risk, they cite some relatively uncommon examples, but then refer advisors to the Business Income Manual for more help and advice. I've beaten the drum before, but at the very least, HMRC's manuals should be used in conjunction with the relevant legislation. But back to the toolkit. And again, like question 2 earlier, if a client says he or she believes they have correctly recorded all of their expenditure, including utilities, etc., at what point do we begin active investigation of each and every record entry as part of our accounts and return preparation? To investigate every entry is beyond doubt is unreasonable, I would suggest. The HMRC toolkit approach would suggest every case should be reviewed every time. So, let's move on to question 11, which says, are all expenses claimed for business trips wholly and exclusively for business purposes? The suspicion has to be that HMRC has experience of holidays or jollies being put through as legitimate expenses. I know as an inspector, and now in the profession assisting people with such issues, that I have seen this more than once. What the toolkit does highlight, though, is the investigative or challenging thought process that an agent is encouraged to adopt to satisfy the toolkit risk. In many cases, this is not clear-cut, and again, whether in reality this is a somewhat unrealistic or unfair conclusion, placing the onus on the advisor remains to be seen. Now, question 12. If a family member accompanied the proprietor or partner on business trips, have any associated non-business costs been disallowed? This articulates a pretty simple tax rule. If the proprietor's other half attends a business trip and that other half has no business reason to be on the trip, then the cost isn't allowable. But I wanted to include it as an extension of the earlier question 11 to draw attention to an apparent close scrutiny that HMRC expect of any business trips. And then again, if we want to adopt the toolkit approach, it's left up to us to pin down the proprietor and to establish what any trips were about and in what capacity any family members attended. As I said, welcome to your new job as a tax inspector. So I mentioned question 13 earlier on, and to remind you, it says, are all expenses claimed for meals and subsistence wholly and exclusively for business purposes? The topic of whether what we would recognise as subsistence costs is a complicated one. HMRC even acknowledge that in the toolkit and then direct us to the business income manual once again. Whilst the inherent complexity of itself is a problem for advisors when possibly considering this risk, take a moment if you can just to read HMRC's comments on their toolkit relating to this risk. You will see, I would suggest, a judgmental and subjective process for deciding, and as an ex-inspector, the opportunity to argue that none or little should be allowed is clear. A complicated area that may require delicate client conversations. Moving on, question 17 asked, have any sponsorship payments made, particularly to connected parties, been reviewed? Like so many of the earlier risk questions that I think are more contentious, this one also stands out due to the connected party aspect. Again, HMRC must have seen a number of cases where businesses have tried to fund certain personal or family projects under the guise of sponsorship. The guidance given by HMRC to this risk is perhaps the most comprehensive and investigative within the toolkit, really expecting us as advisors to have undertaken a very proactive, in-depth consideration, including a full analysis of this complex technical area. Please read the guidance for any clients who make sponsorship payments to see exactly what HMRC expect us to do as our clients' advisors. Question 20. Now, question 20 says, if there have been wages or salaries paid to relatives or connected parties, are the amounts paid commensurate with their duties? So, basically, is the relative getting the market rate for the job or above that? Are they being excessively paid because they are a relative of the proprietor? Interestingly here, the toolkit wording implies there will often be an above-market element to such arrangements, rather than the other toolkit risks, even the earlier contentious ones. A balanced gathering of the facts by the advisor to consider the matter before judgment is the advocated approach, and yet, surprisingly, this is much less so for this risk. The personal and private expenditure toolkit is, conceptually, probably the standalone toolkit of the four, simply as it moves away from a technically led consideration into a much more judgmental, investigative, and as a result, personal consideration. As I said earlier, for those of you wishing to be an inspector for the day, then following the personal and private expenditure toolkit will provide that opportunity. The final toolkit I'd like to look at is that for capital allowances for plant and machinery. Different to the toolkit for personal and private expenditure, and back to the principles of the toolkits for both capital gains for land and buildings and marginal small companies relief. This toolkit on capital allowances has much more resonance to a technical consideration with a possible tax outcome rather than the more basic, understated profit feel that the personal and private expenditure toolkit had. To complete the consistency across the four toolkits, let's begin by acknowledging once again that HMRC believe good record keeping can significantly reduce risks for this topic, and that following the toolkit will also allow a reasonable care defence, should one be needed for subsequent errors. What we have in this toolkit is a large group of risks, 26 in all, solely relating to plant and machinery capital allowances. However, those questions can be grouped into basic matters such as qualification for capital allowances, some technical considerations, and then questions of quantum of qualifying spend. I don't propose as detailed an analysis of this toolkit as the earlier ones, as I suspect most advisors will be almost entirely aware of the types of issue that HMRC draw attention to. For anyone who has completed any level of capital allowances computation, most of the risks HMRC wish considering are fairly self-evident. Having reviewed the toolkit in some depth on its release, I had formed the view that the number of risks HMRC has identified was simply due to the subject matter that is plant and machinery capital allowances, rather than meeting any particular theme or pattern emerging from this toolkit, which is, as I say, fairly standard ground. So, there we have it. My overview of HMRC's new toolkits designed to help us get our clients' self-assessment forms right. Of course, much of this risk-managed approach is driven by the results of HMRC's Working with Agents consultation, where the profession as a group said that we wanted HMRC to identify to us its most commonly seen errors to educate people away from those errors. I hope you have found this podcast useful. HMRC say this move to new toolkits will follow, as HMRC moves to a risk-based way to manage the accuracy of clients' tax returns, then it will be interesting to see what future toolkits do emerge. Thank you.